The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome back to the True Crime Guys podcast. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Michael.
How's everybody doing? Welcome back. Ready for a fun episode this week?
Yeah,
something different. Real. Something different.
No doubt. Black widower, a black widow husband, right? So we call it a black widower.
Yeah, you know, freak accidents can happen in life. They're unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a spouse dies in a really odd way, but when it happens multiple times, you have to start looking a little sideways at the surviving spouse.
Yeah, when it happens twice to the same person and then, you know, big payouts were involved in both.
This guy had both of his wives that he had over the course of 24 years, married to both of them for 12 years each, die in some of the most extraordinary, rarest ways possible. I mean, We'll get into the gritty details, but he went at length to try and make his spouses die in a freakish way.
Two different
ways entirely as well. I think he learned from the first one, and the second one went all out and crazy case.
I think it makes you wonder how many failed plans did he have? How many attempts throughout the years?
We know of one attempt with his second wife for sure.
That's right. So That'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah, and I got a great book for this one. We'll talk about it on the other side. But let's get into your intro and hear what you got for us this week.
Let's do it, man.
911
to address the emergency.
Hello, my name is Harold
Hitthorne.
I'm in the Rocky Mountain National Park.
Okay.
I need an alpine mountain
rescue team
immediately.
Okay, what is your exact location?
My exact location is Deer Mountain. Okay. About 1 mile south of the visitor center.
Okay, I'm going to transfer you to the park, so hang on the line. You're going to hear some clicking, and right now I'm pulling up your lat and your long.
Okay.
On my phone here. Let me try it one more time before I transfer you. They don't have this technology.
I'm sure you know where I am. Sure.
Okay. Yep, I have one moment.
Okay.
Hang on.
Hang right where I am.
And I'll introduce who we are when they pick up the phone.
This is Estes, and we have a gentleman on Deer Mountain. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. My wife has stolen her lost on the north summit of Deer Mountain. On the Deer Mount Trail. And she's in really critical condition. She's had a bad fall. Her
fucking fall, sir.
30, 40 feet, 30 feet.
30, 40 feet.
I think 30 feet.
30 feet. Are you
I am. I need to be sure that you know my location first. For the cell, you have really bad cell coverage.
Okay.
Okay, I'm on Deer Mountain.
Okay.
Near the summit, not the normal, regular, Norman summit, on the southern outcrop.
And, tell me about
the patient. She is a, white female, 50 years old, great health. She has respiration approximately 5 to 8 beats a minute. Her pulse is about, between 50 to 80 beats a minute.
Okay, what's your main injury?
Head injury.
Concussion. Okay, any other injury?
The internal, I don't know.
Conscious,
no, she's not been conscious. She is breathing. She's breathing between 5 and 10, 8 a minute now.
Okay. Hold on just a second.
Okay. Here's the thing. I will pay any and all expenses for a helicopter. I don't care if it's private. I don't care if it's commercial. It wouldn't matter if it's medevac. I will pay any and all expenses right now.
Okay.
Have you drop a paramedic down here?
I understand that, sir. It's really on the safety of everybody involved, so that would really be up to the
weather's good. There's no wind whatsoever right now. Weather is excellent. Visibility is at least 5 to 8 miles. There's definitely I mean, I'm not a paramedic, but I'm doing autism. You could safely drop a paramedic from a 10-foot rope. I could easily do that.
I understand this, sir, but they definitely need to probably get
For our case this week, we are doing, as you mentioned briefly, the Black Widower is what they're calling him. I feel like it's kind of a cliche played out thing in the crime world, you know, when there's a spouse that, or a person that kills multiple spouses, whether it's a man or a woman doing this. We've mm-hmm. seen it several times with women, Dorothy Puente and all these different characters that
right.
kill off their husbands and wives. For
what was the guy, Thomas Randolph?
Yes. What? The guy that's
oh,
in
man.
The prison in,
yeah.
in Southern Nevada, not far from where I live.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That guy reminds me a lot of this guy, but he was a little more, animated, a little more
yeah.
flamboyant, a little more of an actor than this guy is. This guy tried to fly under the radar for the most part, but he still had that confidence where
this guy was a pompous, arrogant son of a bitch if you ran in his circle, if you knew him, and
right.
one of the more controlling people we've ever covered. But yeah, definitely not as theatrical as Randolph was. That guy was
no,
a character.
But just as conceited and narcissistic. Yeah. I mean, he thought everything he said was the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought everyone was an idiot.
He's the ultimate one-upper, this guy. I learned a lot about his character in this book that I got.
Yeah.
It's available on Audible. Fantastic crime book called The Accidents by Caleb Hannon. And I will show Ooh. You a picture if you're watching this on YouTube. The Accidents.
Yes.
It's backwards, obviously, because I'm showing it to the camera. But fantastic book. Just finished it right before we started recording. Tons of details and learned what a complete douchebag, lying, maniacal scumbag this guy Harold Henthorne is.
Right.
And,
so what
let's
point
get
of
into
view,
the story.
What, real quick, what point of view yeah. was the book written from? Is this just some author who just looked into the case or
yes.
is this a defense attorney? Okay.
Yeah, actually, I really like the way that this author ended the book. It's fresh in my mind because I just finished it.
Mm-hmm.
But his kind of notes at the end of the book, I forget what they call that.
Like an epilogue?
Yeah. At the end, he was talking about how he really had reserve. He was thinking he wouldn't write a book on this case just because there was several like multi-hour specials done on it by television, ABC, and whatnot.
Right.
But then like when he started talking to the family of the second wife, the second victim in this, Tony, he learned that they kind of felt cheated by the TV series that they had done, that they would spend all day getting makeup done and telling their side of the story. And then they would be like a 40-second clip that would make the
wow.
cut in the end, you know? And he's like, I wanted to tell the story with all of the details that the family has told us over this time and not shortchange them. And,
right. And you know, the problem with that, the problem with that is that documentaries, they want to tell a story too, and they want to tell the most compelling one. And if you give
yeah.
away too
Speaking
much
of Randolph,
in your
they want to be theatrical with it. And
yeah.
only the most salacious details make it in, and you don't hear as much about like the effect on the family, you know, just the day in and day out grind that they had to deal with. And like, they really had to take their time with this guy because really he was the only one there for both of the wives that were, we find
yeah.
out, killed, but supposedly accidents.
Right.
You know, it was him and the wife, and they were in a secluded area and there was no witnesses. That's the way he planned it. And so it was really hard. You had to really gather a lot of character about him
mm-hmm.
and you had to get as much circumstantial evidence as you could. So the family, there was actually, we'll get
There's
into
a shit ton
later,
of circumstantial evidence though.
It had to have been so tough for for Tony's family, his second wife, because they had to, before they arrested him for killing Tony, they had to like go along with him in order to be able to see their granddaughter and like to build the case. They had to like act like they were still on his side. They were flying to Colorado and meeting with him and hanging out with him, and like all the while knowing damn well that he killed their, you know, daughter, their sister. Yeah.
And he's sitting there thinking, man, they're such idiots. They're buying everything I'm selling.
He's thinking, they're on my side. I got them fooled.
Yeah.
But wow. I feel like we're going far down the weeds and people haven't heard the story yet. So let's get in. Well, let's start from the where this story kind of...
Let's straighten the best way to kick
off. Yeah, the best way to kick it off was with 50-year-old Tony Henthorne and 52-year-old Harold Henthorne, who were celebrating their 12th wedding anniversary on the weekend of September 29th, 2012. And they decided, well, Harold decided, because Harold made every decision and every call, and the two wives that he had didn't get to make any decisions of their own. He decided that for their 12th anniversary, they would hike Colorado's Rocky Mountain National Park together. An area I visited, Estes Park, the area of Estes Park, which is easily the most beautiful place I've ever seen in person. It's amazing. If you've ever seen The Shining, it's that same... Yeah, that same mountain.
That's beautiful.
Just overwhelming. Yeah, so beautiful. So they were going to hike Colorado's Rocky Mountain National Park together for their 12th anniversary, which was going to be tough for Tony, his wife, because she'd had three knee surgeries. She'd had knee problems since she was a teenager, dating back to when she played basketball in school.
Yeah.
And hiking was not easy for her. She had to give up skiing due to her knee issues. So it was once again, the more we learn about this guy, it was a selfish move on his part to want to go hiking, but he also obviously had ulterior motives here.
Right. And I think he later told a park ranger that he was going to take her on an easy hike, mm-hmm. but it was too crowded.
Yeah. His story ends up being all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All over the place.
But they had met. So Tony and Harold had met in late 1999. And gotten married only 9 months later. They actually got engaged the weekend that they met. They had met on a Christian singles website. I believe he flew out to meet her, she flew out to meet him, and that weekend they got engaged. They just were looking for someone. They were in a rush.
Somebody was in a rush, right?
Yeah, Tony wanted to have kids. Harold wanted to have kids apparently as well. And they had both been married prior. And so when they met each other online, it was kind of like, as soon as they met in person, it was like, oh, let's just do this. Let's commit.
Yeah. And then they did have a daughter together.
Yes. But it took 5 years of trying. They were getting up there. They were at this point, they were, you know, in their late 30s, early 40s. I think they were in their early 40s by the time they finally had a kid.
Yeah. I was about to say Harold would have been 40 at the time mm-hmm. they were trying. That would have put Tony at 48. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they were both in their early 40s. Mm-hmm. When they conceived.
Yeah. Now, Tony, her maiden name was Bertolet. She was a successful ophthalmologist from Mississippi. And Harold, as far as what he told Tony and what he told Tony's family and everyone around him, was a very wealthy, mm-hmm. successful fundraiser for hospitals and churches, and a businessman that traveled a lot.
What
and
even
was
is
a multimillionaire?
That?
Which we would come to find out all of it was a complete lie, that he hadn't worked actually since 1990, hadn't had a job.
And a fundraiser for hospitals, though. Like, what the hell? Right? That's lie number one. Why do hospitals need more money?
Right.
I mean, shit, the health field, they make a shit. Just do a couple x-rays a day. And then fundraising for churches. It's just, to me, there's just a lot of gray area in that. Mm-hmm. Quote unquote occupation.
He's trying to keep a job that seems like it's just confusing enough that people won't really understand what he's doing.
Well, not only that, he's trying to pick a hospital and a church is what he helps. You see what I'm saying? Like he just thinks people are like so dumb. He's just like, what's the greatest job somebody could have? Supporting hospitals and mm-hmm. churches. What
you're right.
What do we
I didn't think about it like
here.
That, but his narcissism. He wanted not only did he want to claim that he was a multimillionaire, but he wanted like credit for what he was doing good for humanity
God's
and
work.
Society and everything. Yeah.
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 Come on, dude.
Yeah. They were both heavily, both him, his first wife and his second wife, they were heavily involved in religion, Christian. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he met his second wife on a Christian website, but the same goes for his first wife, which we'll talk about, who died in a tragic accident as well.
Mm-hmm.
But when he met, when Harold met Tony, he told her that he was so rich that she would never have to work again, which, I mean, her she loved that and her family loved that, but it was also, she really didn't need to work anyway. Tony's family was very well off. Her father was in the oil business. He had owned a bunch of land that had a lot of oil on it. He was doing...
Right.
He was fine. Like, none of his kids had to work, nor Tony, nor her her siblings had to work if they didn't want to. They all chose to work because they wanted to.
Right.
And they were raised right.
Yeah, exactly. But, I want to contribute. But,
yeah, but not long after Tony and Harold got married, she became Tony Henthorne. They moved from Mississippi to Colorado, and this was all part of Harold's plan. He mm-hmm. couldn't stand the South, and he part of his control. We see this a lot in crime stories where, you know, there's a domineering man, sometimes right. women, but a lot of times it's the man is very controlling over their wife, and they try to separate them from their family and their connections. And that's exactly what he did. She loved where she was from. She loved Mississippi, but he isolated her back to Colorado. She left her family mm-hmm. and friends behind. And from there on, from the time that they left Mississippi and moved to Colorado, her family didn't talk to her alone, like directly, for like over a decade, because every time they would call, Harold would be on, answer the phone. And can you imagine how annoying that is? Like, if you're her father, you're trying to talk to, you call to talk to your daughter, and
yeah,
you're forced to talk to her husband the whole time. He won't get off the phone.
Right. And he thinks you want to talk to him too.
He's trying to convince you of that. But of course, like it's just a control tactic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
God.
So as we mentioned a minute ago, in 2003, after several years of trying, 5 years of attempting, they finally had a child, a daughter named Haley, who at the time that we began this story, at the time of their 12-year anniversary in 2012, Haley was now 9 years old. Mm. And sadly, after this anniversary hike, she would never see her mother alive again. So let's get into this hike and this tragic accident, air quotes.
Right.
So Harold and Tony set out on that hike in 2012 at about 3:30 p.m. on that day, and they left the trail, according to Harold, and had lunch on a scenic trail. Part of that was supposedly because there was too much foot traffic and they wanted some isolation. Mm-hmm. They found this scenic cliff below where they had lunch, and his story would be all over the place as to, you know, why they went to this cliff's edge. First, right. It was they were having a picnic. That it was also said that Tony was trying to get this perfect picture. She had seen some turkeys, which later, like the park ranger that would respond to this accident would be like, there's not really turkeys in this part of the woods or whatever. And he'd be like, oh, well, maybe it was a deer. Oh, actually, we were down here to have sex. So he changes his story.
Wow.
A couple times. That's why we were going to a secluded spot.
Yeah. And all the while, doesn't lose any confidence in any of these theories, does he?
Right. No, he's totally. Been a lifetime. He spent a lifetime of bullshitting people, so he's a
yes,
pro at it.
Yes, absolutely.
So, at a little after 5 p.m., Tony Henthorne would fall 130 feet from that cliff that they had supposedly had lunch or whatever they had done to the ground below, hitting her head, basically scalping her. She had a massive gash on her head that almost immediately lost her a third of her blood in her body, according to the coroner or to the medical examiner. Harold called 911 approximately 45 minutes later. So at about like 5:50-ish, he called. He claimed that it took him 15 minutes to get down to her and then another 30 minutes to assess the situation.
Wow. How about call 911 and then make your way down? How about that?
Precisely.
Wow. Yeah. Red flag number one. Here we go. Yeah.
And the 911 operator, you know, was a little thrown off because he had so much weird information. Like right away, he's telling the 911 operator, one of the first things he says is what her pulse and her heart rate was.
Mm-hmm.
And the operator's like, are you a paramedic? And he's like, no. And, you know, he was all over the place. And then the operator's trying to get him to perform CPR. And he's saying his phone's about to die. Even though he would then go on to make a crap load of phone calls and texts after hanging up. So it was a 4-minute call with 911 operator. And they're trying to, you know, organize the park ranger to get there because obviously he's already in there and he's just got to hike over a couple canyons to get there. And they're also trying to, you know, get some sort of, you know, paramedics in there. but it's going to take a while because he intentionally made this as far back as he could go. Like, he had planned this whole thing.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, man.
He said, so he's telling, you know, the responders that he didn't actually see her fall. He was reading text messages and that she was looking over the edge trying to get a perfect picture. Mm-hmm. And he just saw a blur. And then, he went over to the edge and saw her laying down there.
Right.
It was initially assumed an accident, as it, you know, of course you're going to think as responders, like, man, this is a freak accident. This married couple.
Right. This married couple of 12 years.
Yeah.
Right. You're not, this is a freak
you don't know
accident.
His backstory. You don't know that his first wife died in a very weird way.
Right. Not yet.
That being said, he was not showing a lot of emotion. He never did throughout this whole thing, with whether it was the funeral, being around the family members.
Right.
He was basically stone cold calculated, and the same thing at the scene here. No emotion, no crying.
Which is crazy, because you would think he'd be trying to put on some type of act, some type of gimmick, right? You're not selling it very good. But I guess, like, he just had that much confidence in his little scheme here.
Yeah. So as you briefly mentioned earlier, Harold would tell the ranger that got there first that, you know, he was initially going to, they were supposed to hike Bear Lake Trail, but had changed to Deer Mountain Trail to avoid crowds.
Apparently Bear Lake Trail is like a zero elevation gain type
of
trail.
Yeah, it's paved. It's it's like an old people trail, apparently. It's very, very easy.
Right, whereas instead, Deer Mountain Trail, I mean, it has mountain in the name, so you're going up.
Instead, Harold decided it would be a better idea to hike Deer Mountain Trail for their anniversary, which is a 1,200-foot climb from its trailhead to its 10,200-foot summit. With his wife of 12 years that has had three knee surgeries.
On the same knee.
Yeah. So his story, as we mentioned, is all over the place. He told police that he had never been on the Deer Mountain Trail before, but police discovered via cell phone records later. This was the nail in the coffin. He got away with this crime for a while, years, until a second look, and police decided to really dig into his cell phone records, and that's when they discovered there had in fact been 8 times in a 6-week period leading up to Tony's accident, quote unquote, in which he had visited this park, and basically he was scoping out the perfect location. Yeah.
Yep.
And even more amazing, police found a map in his car. I don't know how the fuck he didn't think about this, but they found a map in his car with a pink X on the spot where Tony fell. Literally X marking the spot of where he committed, clearly pushed her off this cliff.
But to be fair, that could just be like, that's the spot I was going to picnic with her. You know, like
yeah,
that's
but
spot.
He told them initially that he hadn't been there, and
he fucked up on that. He shouldn't have said that. If you don't say that, then you know what I'm saying. Yeah. Then you could easily explain the X. Be like, that was our destination for the hike. I knew she didn't want to go all the way to the top. She couldn't, so I thought, we'll stop here. You know, have a little picnic. But like you say, the fact that he said he'd never been to the park before, that's detrimental to this whole story. Fucks up everything.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about the 911 call, which is definitely an issue. Yeah. When the operator tried to get him to assist in CPR, he insisted that he couldn't speak long due to his low battery on his phone. But after hanging up after a 4-minute call with 911 operator, he went on to make 22 calls and send and receive 98 text messages.
Jesus.
And the book went into detail about all these messages that he was sending and the times of them and how odd it is. And clearly, this whole thing was him murdering someone. So, like, the times of his text, he was sending texts to everyone, and it started out with...
What was he saying, though? What were these texts, what were they about?
It started out with Tony's brother, so he was sending texts to her to let her family know, and it was like, hey, whatever his name was, there was an accident, we were hiking in Rocky Mountain National Park, ... She fell, ... She's in critical condition, ... And it was like ongoing story. And then eventually the last text was she's gone, ... But he was sending these same texts to like everyone he knew, people he hadn't talked to in months, in the middle of the night. Even after she was pronounced dead, he was still sending the texts leading people on that she was still alive, which is just completely bizarre. I don't understand the motive behind it.
That is strange.
Isn't it? It's like he was an attention whore or something. I don't understand it at all. Like he sent that same first text that he sent to her brother to like acquaintances hours after she was already dead. Like what was it like urgent message, Tony has been injured, ... She's already dead, by the way. Like, he's sending these texts to people for some reason saying she's hurt when she's already dead, and he knows it.
Like you say, I guess that's just for attention. He just wants to be captivating. Yeah. He wants to hold your attention.
Mm-hmm. And he also wants as many people on his side. He's trying to beat the police to the punch and get as many people on his side as he can.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That way, when police go question people, they can be like, yeah, he texted me when it happened, you know?
This is one of his things that he liked to do. He had kind of a trend you could see between his first two, his two marriages. Mm-hmm. And he liked to keep the family members and friends of his wives really close and get them on his side. So like at his wedding with Tony, his first wife, who had died tragically, almost all of her family was at the wedding for his second wife. And like he had kept in contact with them and invited them to this wedding. And it was his way of getting his new wife's family to believe he was a good guy or whatever it was.
That is weird.
Yeah, right?
I mean, motive, if that's your motive or not, even if that is your motive, that's still weird. Why do you need to do that?
Yep. Police, after digging in a little more, found a motive and, of course, financial gain here. Several life insurance policies with Harold as the beneficiary were discovered, amounting to over $4 million. That's a lot of life insurance.
Yeah, I guess she didn't have to work, huh?
Right.
fundraiser my ass.
Right, for real. One of these policies, he had recently changed the beneficiary from their daughter, Haley, to himself. That doesn't look suspicious at all.
Wow. So all of them were in his name, or did he still have some in the daughter's name?
No, they were all in his. He had changed the one that was for their daughter to his name right before the accident.
Wow, that is a piece of shit move.
Yeah.
I mean, that's his real daughter. That blows me away.
Yeah. Now, Tony's family had liked Harold initially, but over the years, over the course of that 12 years, they had grown to hate him and be fearful of what, his control and what he might do. And in fact, Tony's mother had actually warned her the one time over that 12-year span that she had actually got to talk to her daughter one-on-one. She had made a visit to Colorado and actually sat down with her in her bedroom and had basically had a heart-to-heart, like, because there was an incident that we'll talk about where he had attempted to kill her prior that her mother was concerned about, and she warned her, like, don't go anywhere alone with him. I know he's your husband, but, like, she was basically saying, like, I think that he'd already tried to kill you and he's not above doing it again. And unfortunately, her mother was foreshadowing there because it actually had happened.
Yeah. Sometimes your mama got that good intuition.
Yeah.
You know?
So when Tony's friends and family heard how she died, especially her father, he was able to put into words what many of them were thinking. His first quote when he found, he heard what had happened was, he pushed her. That was what her father said.
Yeah, he ain't fucking around, boy.
Yeah, he knew.
he knew right away.
So then police discovered that this wasn't old Harold's first marriage. Imagine. And in fact, his first wife's tragic death was even more suspicious than the second. And what's odd is that both of these wives' tragic accidents, quote unquote, had happened on their 12-year anniversary, right around that week.
Yeah.
So apparently 12 years is his bookend for marriage. He can't go any further than that before he has to cash in.
Right. That's his limit.
That's really like the long game, you know? Like, you think like 6-7 years would get the point across that you were in love and whatnot, and like you put in your time and you weren't just trying to cash out.
Maybe, but like I said, I think he's just waiting until that life insurance policy runs out, and that's just how long it was, probably.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I imagine the longer you're with someone, the better policies you could get, because they see that you're like really been together a long time and you're less likely to knock each other off, I would think. Like, if I'm a life insurance company, I'm not giving you a great policy when you just got married. I'm like,
and you've been paying on the policy for 12 years, so what the hell are they going to say when you come to cash out? You know, it's not like you just took it out 6 months ago. They've been paying on it for 12 years.
Yeah,
it looks legit.
Yeah, so let's get into his first wife, the first marriage that he had that ended tragically. Harold met his first wife, Lynn, in college, and the two soon took to each other. They were both heavily involved in Christian church. Mm-hmm. And they appeared to be really happy, and thus friends were delighted when the duo decided to tie the knot. But even after marriage, Harold and Lynn settled down into a peaceful life, and nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Once again, this was the same situation with Tony, where he took her back to Colorado, his stomping grounds. He had, they'd met in college, but like they, you know, he lived far away, thousands of miles away from where she lived. And he basically took her back to Colorado with him, isolated her from her family, just like he did later with Tony.
Yep.
And on May 6, 1995, after 12 years of marriage, right around their 12-year anniversary, Harold and Lynn decided to take a drive down an almost deserted highway in Sedalia, Colorado. This highway that Harold had chosen had little to no traffic, and this was just supposed to be a nice, peaceful drive. However, a tire flat changed everything. An alleged tire flat. We would later find out
that basically this tire was just barely
deflated.
Yeah, it had like 15 PSI in it. You can roll on that for a little bit.
Yeah. And in fact, the spare that they were putting on had only had like 19 PSI. So it was basically the same thing.
It wasn't even any better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Visually, you wouldn't even be able to tell the difference.
Yeah. So Harold pulls over saying something's wrong with the car. It was dark. There was no cell service and there were no houses nearby. And the nearest hospital was a near 40-minute drive. And after confirming that it was a troublesome tire, Harold propped the vehicle up on a couple of jacks ready for a tire change and somehow convinced Lynn, who was a very cautious person. The book went into detail about Lynn, his first wife, and how cautious she was about everything. She was the type of person that parked like 50 feet from the nearest car in a parking lot and would actually leave her window down and the glove box open just to, so that no one would like break the window to see that there was nothing in her car. About how she always kept like a $50 bill stashed away in the darkest part of her wallet just in case. She was a very cautious person and always thought things through. So the idea that on this dark, secluded highway that she would go under to fix this tire that nothing was even wrong with.
Yeah.
And then have these jacks fall. So what happens is somehow the car, she's under there working on the tire. And what we know now happened was that Harold had put the car up on two jacks, and when she went down there, he kicked the side panel right above the tire that was off, kicking the car off the jacks and landing on his wife, killing her instantly.
And you may be like, well, why was she under the car? Well, somehow the lug nuts ended up underneath the car. Mm-hmm. Harold says they rolled up under there. Okay, first off, lug nuts aren't even round, and then you're on gravel. Where are they rolling to? Mm-hmm. Like
he rolled them bitches like dice down under the car.
He sure did. He sure did, yeah.
Yeah, and there was actually a footprint on the rear panel of the car right above the tire well where the tire was removed, where Lynn was.
Wow.
So, and the initial detectives, they were new to the force. They were not very well practiced. They took him at his word that this was a freak accident, unfortunately. And they did get a picture of the footprint on the car, and they got a picture of his the shoes that he was wearing, and they never matched him up. They never compared them. It was quickly ruled by a coroner as an accident within a week, and no real investigation was ever done.
Oh my God. Well, they did test that later on. They did test the theory because he said that he slammed the back hatch and the car fell off the jack.
Fell off the jacks when he threw the spare tire into the back, right?
Yeah, well, they tested this. The police department tested all these theories. It would not do it. But
the only one that worked
was
kicking
that shit. Spartan kicking that bitch will knock it off the jack every time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what did it.
Yep.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, so several suspicious facts about the incident were noteworthy. For example, the tire that stopped they stopped to change was not flat, but merely was low. As we mentioned, it was at 15 pounds out of 44, and the spare that they were putting on was at 19, so 4 pounds more than the one that was supposedly flat. And his story was – it's amazing to me this because this guy was – incredibly meticulous. And like, so like there was details in this book about the wedding with Tony and how this, he had planned everything to it. He like, typically what a woman does leading up to a wedding, you know, they get together with their mom or whatever, and they plan out the wedding, and the men are like, yeah, whatever you want to do. And like, give their two cents. He was the one that planned it like over the top, like five notebooks worth of shit. Like everyone had to have their role. He was such a control freak in everything. And so for me to think that he just wung it as far as the details of like knowing he was going to do these crimes, and then seemingly just his story's all over the place with everyone he talks to. Like, I would have thought he would have had the details like memorized, like this is exactly what happened, and not change it with anybody. But he was all over the place with the different police officers that responded to his first wife's accident. Yeah. He was telling them all a different story of where they had gone, where they were going, how it happened.
Well, he thought that his plan was so good, and the accident would have been such a freak thing that no one would question it, Lorne. You know? I mean, come on.
Yeah,
his plan
is
great.
He got away with it. He got away with it for how long?
He did.
You know?
He did. Technically, he's never been punished for it, right? He still hasn't.
True. But that day is going to come, I think. We'll talk more about that in a bit. So, to one cop, Harold said that they were driving east. To another, he said west. To one cop, he said that him and Lynn had ate dinner at a nearby restaurant just prior to the accident. To another, he said that they were on their way to the restaurant. To one cop, he said that he and Lynn had left the house to go on a drive at 1 p.m. To another, he said 7 p.m. To one cop, he said that the tire they pulled out to change was completely flat. To another, he said it was merely spongy. Yeah, a lot of people pull over on a dark highway in the middle of nowhere because their tire is spongy, you know.
Yeah.
Don't you get home and then fill up the tire later or the next day or something?
Right. Maybe see how far you can make it, you know?
Yeah. To one cop, he said that he had jacked up the fallen car and pulled Lynn out from underneath in a desperate attempt to save her life. To another, he said it wasn't him, that she was actually rescued by a group of random strangers, which we would find out later was absolutely true, that there was a family that had been happened to be driving through that area, and he waved them down and actually let them, like he actually yelled at them when they pulled Lynn out from under the car and tried to do CPR on him. And when they were trying to get him to use his jacket to keep her warm because it was cold out there, he had this nice jacket on. He wouldn't do it. So they had to use their own fucking jacket on her. And he's just standing around. He's standing around while they're trying to save him or save his wife.
Of course, he doesn't want to save her. Man, but what a piece of shit. It's like, you're not even going to act like you want to save her.
When detectives finally later on contacted this witness that had tried to save Lynn, the first thing the witness said, what was her name? I forget. But she basically said, did you arrest the husband yet? She knew. Like the behavior was so bizarre.
Wow. She just came right out with it. Mm-hmm. It's like, on the contrary. We went sent home and we went ahead and gave him his life insurance policy. He's good to go.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. So... here's the detail of what I just talked about. At around 10 p.m., Harold flagged down a car and told the occupants that the car had fallen on top of his wife. They drove back up the road to find a house and call 911. When they couldn't find the phone, they returned to try and help. Two men were able to lift the car up and free Lynn, who was unconscious. Then Harold angrily screamed at them not to touch her. Even over his objections, they started CPR and got her breathing again briefly. Meanwhile, another passenger left the scene to try and find a phone and returned with blankets after finding someone to call 911 without, you know, he wasn't willing to give up his jacket, so they had to go get blankets.
Right.
His story was all over. It's amazing to me that he got away with this first one, to be honest.
Seriously.
But it was just the right location, young detectives that just, for whatever reason, believed him, even though his story... I mean, I guess someone could be distraught, and maybe, you know, it's hard to recall exactly what happened when it just happened, but his story was all over the place.
I guess just the incident in itself is so strange. You know, imagine pulling up on this, and a car falls on somebody. You're like, wow, this is a horrible accident.
The first thing you're not thinking is it was murder, right?
No! Why would you be thinking it's a murder? Like, a car fell on somebody. It doesn't...
Especially a couple that's been married for 12 years.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. So in that instance, you know, you got to kind of cut them a little bit of slack, but it should have been investigated much more thoroughly, for sure.
Yeah. So when law enforcement asked Harold whether Lynn's life was insured, he disclosed only one of the multiple life insurance policies that he would collect on, and he would ultimately collect $600,000 in life insurance, including proceeds from a policy that went into effect only 2.5 months before her death, and from an accidental death rider. So he added in a part of the policy that would pay him even more if there was an accidental death, which doubled the benefit from $150,000 to $300,000.
That's why he did the accidental death stuff. Okay. Yep. Okay, I get it now. Because this whole story, I was sitting here trying to figure out, I'm like, why didn't he just, there's lots of other ways.
To kill a person, right?
I mean, if you're a narcissistic piece of shit anyway, like you don't have any attachment, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, why is he going through all this trouble to make it an accident? It's all for the money. Wow. Fucking balls of this dude. Unreal. Yep.
So while law enforcement briefly investigated Lynn's death as a suspicious incident, investigators eventually determined her death was an accident despite the unusual circumstances, and partly that was due to the coroner ruling it an accident instead of undetermined, which would happen with his second wife. The coroner's ruling of was undetermined or something along those lines, and that left it open for more investigation as opposed to immediately ruling it an accident.
Yeah, they said homicide cannot be ruled out, I believe, was on the bottom of the report.
Yeah. Douglas County, where that occurred, had changed a lot over the years. A formal rural ranching community turned into one of the fastest growing counties in the nation. So back then it was more of a rural, small town thing. Mm-hmm. But over the years, the sheriff's office grew with the larger community from a few dozen to some 500 employees. But at the time of Lynn's death, there were only five detectives covering an area half the size of Rhode Island. Douglas County wasn't prepared to investigate Lynn's death, not only because they'd never seen one like it, but because they weren't prepared for anything of this magnitude. So they were just out of their league with that first murder that he did.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And he knew that. He knew that. In this desolate road, in this small town, this small county or whatever, he knew. He knew exactly what he was doing. Because this is in Colorado. That's why he takes out all of them to his home turf.
Yeah. Yeah. His stomping grounds.
Yeah. He knows what's up.
Within less than a week, Douglas County's coroner declared Lynn Henthorne's death an accident. All of her belongings, along with her Jeep, were returned to Harold. The Jeep was then salvaged, and no physical evidence remained. So, that was that.
Wow.
Until he does it again, and, then people start saying, hey, how many freak accidents can a man have with his wife?
Exactly. Highly suspicious ones as well, with tons of circumstantial evidence.
Yeah.
You can't have more than one, apparently.
Mm-hmm. So let's fast forward back to 2012. Now, with a boatload of circumstantial evidence, police arrested Harold, especially after looking into his past and seeing the very bizarre death of his first wife as well. I think that would played a huge role in them wanting to investigate him further.
Oh, absolutely.
And they would ultimately charge him with first-degree murder for the death of his second wife, Tony. And prosecutors would argue that Harold carefully staged Tony's death to cash in on several life insurance policies totaling over $4 million. They seized on Harold Henthorne's inconsistent accounts of the fatal fall and said that evidence did not match his shifting stories. They described how he had scouted the trail during 8 different trips to the Estes Park area. Mm-hmm. And they say he was searching for, quote, the perfect place to murder someone, where there would be no witnesses and no chance of her surviving, prosecutor Sunetta Hazra said. A coroner said that he could not determine whether she fell or was pushed, but he said he found no evidence that Harold actually performed CPR on his wife, despite what he told dispatchers. So he did say that he had performed CPR on her, and the people on the phone, they were skeptical. Because I think he talked initially for 4 minutes, and then he talked to him again, supposedly after doing CPR, and they were really thrown off because usually people are really winded after performing CPR for anything more than a couple minutes. It's exhausting.
Right.
He was not out of breath at all. And then after examining, Tony's body, there was no sign that her lipstick wasn't even smudged, and there was no damage to like your xiphoid or whatever it's called.
From the compressions.
Yeah. Then there was the park rangers that told the jury that Harold could not explain why he had a park map of the area with an X drawn at the spot where his wife fell. That's a hard one to get past.
I can't believe he didn't have any explanation, though. I mean, nothing? I mean, you tried to explain your way out of everything else. How do you not have an explanation for this?
Yeah. Prosecutors argued that the fall was reminiscent of the death of Henthorne's first wife, Sandra Lynn, in 1995, several months after their 12th wedding anniversary. Bizarre. Yep. Bizarre that it was both on the 12th anniversary. That is weird. So as Henthorne had not been charged in the death of his first wife, police reopened the investigation after Tony Henthorne's death. right. details of the earlier case. They were thankfully the judge allowed the details of his first wife's death to be permitted in the trial, and so it really told the story of a guy who is doing this more than once, cashing in on these life insurance policies, and the details of what he'd been up to since 1990, the fact that he had not worked steadily since 1990 and had all the while gone around claiming to be a millionaire to everyone. So there was so many character witnesses that came in and told about all of his lies. When he said he was on business, it actually turned out he was going to a local Panera Bread and annoying all the staff at this Panera Bread day after day. He was doing nothing, and he was dominating, you know, both of his wives' lives up until he took them from them.
Yeah.
Secluding them from their families. He was just a horrible, horrible person. And he was the same way with the daughter, with Haley. I mean, he dominated, like, once they had Haley, he controlled every second of her life as well. To the point where Tony would be at work all day. She ran a practice for ophthalmology, and she would get home, and he would already have Haley in bed, like earlier than any kid goes to bed. He'd put her to bed at like 6 o'clock just so that Tony couldn't see her own daughter when she got home from work. She'd already be in bed. Jesus. She had to eat every time he ate, to the point where she had constipation apparently, because like that was how controlling when he ate, she had to eat. He was controlling every part of her life.
Well, yeah, it's extreme narcissist, man. And he sees himself in her, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So her failure is his failure, and so on. You know what I mean? Like extreme helicopter parents. I feel like they have, that's their issue a lot.
I feel like he had a kid just so that he could do this, impose his will, and get even more control over his wife. It was just another means of controlling her.
Shit, maybe. Maybe, yeah. And it's also another tie, too. It makes them look even more connected and in love, right? I mean, they have a child together. 12 years of marriage and a child together? Like, we're bonded.
Yeah. So prosecutors during the trial said that Harold made phony business cards to make it seem like he was a hardworking fundraiser for churches and nonprofits, but investigators found no evidence that he had any income from regular employment. He had a suite, but really it was the basement of their Colorado home. He insisted to anyone who would listen that he was an in-demand fundraiser who had a large staff and made millions a year, yet every time Tony managed to sneak a look at his finances, she found that their bank accounts weren't nearly as flush as he made them out to be, so she was not impressed. And this is after they had gotten apparently approximately $500,000 from Tony's parents. They were very generous. They paid for down payment on their Colorado home. They paid for the wedding, everything.
Well, why did he need that if he's got so much money, you know?
Exactly. And despite the fact that Tony's parents, the Bertolais, had been extra generous to Harold and Tony, gifting them some $500,000 for a down payment on their house, as I just mentioned, for cars and new appliances and anything else they needed in the 10 years since they'd been married. Still, over the course of Harold and Tony's 12-year marriage, Bob and Yvonne Bertolais, Tony's parents, watched their daughter change. At one time, she had been assertive and confident until she met Harold, and that all changed. That is what sucks, is like apparently she was the type that didn't take shit from anybody growing up, but he just knew how to control people.
Well, when you take somebody out of their element like that, especially a small town person, take them out of their element.
He took over her practice, her ophthalmology office.
What?
He annoyed her whole staff. He would go in there and start like telling them when to schedule things and how to do things and answering phone calls. And then he ended up selling her practice. Like he put it up for sale and she didn't even know. And she's getting a call about the practice being up for sale. Just another way for him to dominate and control her life.
Dude's a psychopath, man. He's an absolute psychopath.
Yep.
I can't believe these women stayed with him for 12 years. Maybe they were genuinely afraid to leave.
Well, also he picked really, really deeply religious women that they believed in, you know, what the Bible said about marriage, that it was sacred and not to be broken, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And Tony was actually... She was on an online Christian advice website. She was like one of the more popular advice givers to young women that, you know, were struggling with things and whatnot. She did that for years. She's very intelligent.
Yeah. Wow.
Basically, Tony's family came on the stand and talked about his controlling nature and how their daughter had changed. And even though Harold supposedly had all this money, he refused to travel back and forth to the South, to Mississippi, where she was from, to see her family. And if Tony's parents wanted to see their daughter and their granddaughter, they had to get on a plane, which had become a burden because both of them, as they got up in age, had both suffered mild strokes. And yet Tony's, she still couldn't go down there and see her family.
That's fucked up.
And every time they called, Harold would be the one to answer. As I talked about earlier, he would put them on speakerphone and do the majority of the talking while Tony's voice came in a faint and distant background as she was standing, as if she was standing in another room.
Yeah, that wouldn't fly, man. I'd have to make a trip out there somehow.
Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah, there's no way. If I couldn't talk to my daughter at all and I seen that, I'd be like, all right, I'm just going to show up out the blue. Mm-hmm. There's gonna be a knock at the door. It's gonna be me, Mitch.
Yep. Tony's parents, the Bertolais, hoped that life might get better when for Tony when the birth of their daughter occurred in 2005, but they found that things only got worse. The control was even worse with young Haley. Harold planned every one of the little girl's days and nights, organized play dates with other parents, told Haley when and what to eat, and made it clear to everyone paying attention that he, not Tony, was in charge. He refused to allow Tony to put Haley to bed at night, insisting that the hour or so before Haley fell asleep was daddy-daughter time, even after she'd fallen asleep, keeping a video monitor running in her in Haley's room to keep an eye on things.
Jesus.
Then came the incident in the cabin. This is what the other attempt on Tony's life prior to the push off the cliff that we alluded to earlier. Yes. So Harold had bought this little cabin in the mountains, west of Denver, and they would make frequent trips up there, him, Tony, and Haley. And at the cabin late one night, while Haley slept, Harold asked Tony to help him clean up some debris. Now, keep in mind, it's 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
He was a clean freak, meticulous. He insisted that Tony do everything his way. Towels had to be folded a certain way, all of that. So to think that something needed to be cleaned up at 11 o'clock at night, it just doesn't strike me as right, first of all. But while standing below a raised porch with her back turned, Tony felt the weight of something heavy hit her in the neck and knock her to the ground. And she had a severe concussion and neck injury from this. And basically, Harold had supposedly thrown this piece of lumber off the second floor deck and struck, perfectly hitting Tony in the back of the neck.
Yeah,
and she said that she had coincidentally just bent down to pick something up right as that hit her, and had it not, she's convinced it would have hit her in the head and killed her. So she got
okay. So there was debris on the roof. Like, I mean, he says debris, but there's a
it's vague. Of
fucking,
course, he's it's a bullshit like story.
Damn, but it sounds like it was.
It sounds like it was a large beam, is what it sounds like.
That's what it sounds like to me as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Afterwards, she discovered what had hit her and hurt her so badly, a large piece of lumber that Harold had thrown off the porch. She's convinced that had she not moved a millisecond before, that it would have hit her right in the head and killed her. And this is the event that Tony's mother really started to realize what they were dealing with in Harold and how dangerous he was, because she was convinced that this was an attempt on her daughter's life.
Right. Just the fact that you took your wife out at 11 p.m. to do this is not safe.
Right.
Like, if you feel that strongly that you need to go do that, then go do it your damn self.
Exactly.
You know? Exactly. It's just that the whole thing is iffy.
And just the idea that you would throw a large wooden beam off a balcony when there's even a slight chance that your wife or kid or anybody would be below is just insane.
It's insane. That's what I'm saying. Just the whole situation is just, I can't believe these women didn't see this shit before.
Yeah. So this is all stuff that the jury would hear during the 2-week trial in 2015. Prosecutors argued that Harold carefully staged Tony Henthorne's death to look like an accident because he stood to benefit from her $4.7 million in life insurance policies, which she didn't know existed.
Wow.
And they did a good enough job portraying his character and all the details of these two, you know, the two suspicious deaths of his wife's. Mm-hmm. Good enough job that it only took the jury about 10 hours to find Harold Henthorne guilty of first-degree murder for the death of his second wife. He was 59 years old at the time. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Recently, or a few years after that, he, of course, filed an appeal, which was denied. And now there's talks that they could start to maybe put together a trial for his first wife's death, because they didn't want to happen was his there to be a chance that he gets the appeal actually goes through, and then they have, you know, they can't use the second wife's death as, you know, part of the case for the first wife's death. They think they have a much less chance of convicting him for his first wife's death if the second one got appealed. So they don't want, they basically want to keep him in prison and make sure they dot their I's and cross their T's here.
Yeah, I agree. This some bitch needs to stay in prison, man, because he's just going to hurt somebody else.
Yeah.
Because this is the type of person that he just, if he got away with this or he gets out, then that just bolsters his confidence. Just like getting away with his first wife, killing his first wife.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him to then sue the justice, you know, the judicial system for wrongful imprisonment or whatever and get even more millions out of this if somehow he gets out.
Oh, I know. He's the perfect candidate for some bullshit like that.
Yeah. Shit. Well, that's our case.
That's
right. You know, it's a perfect candidate for your armpits.
What is that?
Oh my Gaia.
Oh my Gaia, dude. Oh my Gaia is an innovative, all natural deodorant, fragrance, and beard oil company specializing in paraben and aluminum free products. Guys, their innovative line of deodorants inhibit the growth of odor causing bacteria while maintaining effectiveness. At Oh My Gaia, they use only all natural, paraben and aluminum free organic ingredients. And there's tons of scents to choose from, guys, from vanilla, cherry almond, sandalwood, lavender, lemongrass, Egyptian musk. That's one of my favorites. Today I'm rocking Barbershop, another one. Nice, clean smell. I love Barbershop. But because you guys are True Crime Guys listeners, you can use the word creeper for 15% off your order. That's C-R-E-E-P-E-R for 15% off your order at ohmygaia.com or shop_ohmygaia on Instagram. Okay, that's ohmygaia.com, ohmygaia.com, and again, that's 15% off your order with code creeper. And as always, there's links to Oh My Gaia right below the description of this episode, as well as our next sponsor, Tonic CBD.
That's right. Support small businesses that support us, like Oh My Gaia and like Tonic CBD. It's true, not all CBD products are created equal. From how the hemp is grown and processed or how it's formulated and delivered into your body, every step matters. And that's why Tonic is so special. They have original formulas using CBD, adaptogens, herbs, and superfoods. And they work to deliver the most effective, intentional, sustainable products. You know, that CBD you get at the gas station is not, it can't hold a candle to the real deal here.
No.
They cultivate their own hemp on a certified organic family farm in upstate New York. That hemp travels only 30 minutes to their state-of-the-art manufacturing and distribution facility, where it's turned into a finished product and sent to you, ensuring only the highest quality vibes at every step of the process. They have a bunch of different blends. Yeah, it's much like Oh My Gaia has a bunch of different scents. They have a bunch of different blends depending on your needs. Chill Tonic is one of my favorites. It helps with anxiety, and it's got some superfoods in it. It has ashwagandha, lemon balm, and passion flower to deliver a super calming effect. Mm-hmm. And it also has black seed oil, which is a antioxidant powerhouse.
It's great for your immune system,
but just scratches the surface of what superfood can do. It's really easy also to certify or to verify the quality of their products. There's a microchip on the top of each container, which if you tap your phone on, gives you the details, their third-party lab reports, product information, details about their farm, and even helpful blog posts that provide you with CBD information. I recommend you check out their Instagram page, Tonic CBD. I'm not sure exactly what the tag is, but if you just search that, you'll find it. Mm-hmm. And there's stories that show you their farm. That's kind of what attracted me to them and had me reach out to them as a potential sponsor for the show. And the best part is if you visit tonicvibes.com and use code word creeper at checkout, you get 20% off your order. That's tonicvibes.com, code word creeper, as always, and you get 20% off. So definitely check it out. It's a part of my daily life. I take CBD day and night when I wake up and before bed. And it helps with sleep. It helps with just keeping my mood stable and many other benefits. So definitely give it a chance and help a small business that's helping us out as well.
Absolutely. All right. We got any, we going to do some reviews or you want to talk Patreon?
You talk Patreon while I look up the reviews here.
Sounds good. Guys, number one way to support the show and what we do here at TCG Productions is to go check out Patreon. Patreon.com/truecrimeguys. And you can sign on at the $2 tier and get access to that 1 week a month where we don't do a free episode. You'll get access to that episode, including the entire backlog of all of those episodes for the last 5 years. And if you bump up to the $5 tier, then you get everything we make. Everything True Crime Guys Productions makes. That's every Patreon exclusive, every TCG Patreon exclusive, every Just the Banter, which is every single Friday with video as well. Strange Shorts is on Mondays. And Strange and Unexplained proper, you get early releases to that. Our other podcast, Strange and Unexplained, it's available on free platforms. You get early releases every Thursday, so you can listen to your TCG releases Wednesday and Thursday. And then also, did I say Strange Shorts already? Did I say Strange Shorts on Monday?
Yep, you said Strange Shorts. Did you say okay. Higher Thoughts? Did you say 5 Minute Murder Show? There's so many.
I didn't say 5 Minute Murder Show yet. That's Saturday. So I was going down the week. Yeah. And it's almost every other day at least.
Just to the store, you get a shitload of stuff for $5 a month.
Yeah, $5 a month. It's cheaper than your coffee. It's cheaper than a gallon of gas, depending on where you live.
We haven't even adjusted for inflation, so get in now.
That's right. We're about to move everything to the $10 tier. Shit's getting crazy. Right. But patreon.com/truecrimeguys, just like everything else that we plugged, there is links right below the description.
Right on. I want to take a minute to thank everybody who has gone and rated and reviewed the show, or at least the ones that I can find on this website here. I want to say thank you to Will3433 from the US, says Creeper for Life, found them in March, just got done catching up, going to binge Strange, then it'll be time to become a patron and start binging some more. Love the banter, good balance of humor with the terrible stories. Also don't mind the sports talk. Raider Nation, OG Oakland. Get out of here. On the other side of the bay, homie, was before you guys came to Vegas, was the real team.
Oh.
The 40 Winus.
The 40 Winus.
Then we got Swag6782 from the US, says Mason Lusk. I guess maybe that's your name. Absolute gold, y'all. Listen to y'all all day, and ain't a better way to make the workday fly by than a good murder story. Keep up the good work, and God bless. Thumbs right up. On. Thank you very much, Swag6782.
Yes.
And we got one more from ATX Bree from the US as well. Says, I work overnight and binged all of Killer Queens, Tori and Tyrella. Gave a sneak peek of y'all's show, and I gave it a listen. I started from the newest and already on episode 153. Wow. You've been busy. She also says, y'all are hilarious. Love the show. Immediately subscribed and will join Patreon once I've binged it all. So a big shout out to Killer Queens for sure. And right, any of the listeners that have come over from them to us, welcome. And thanks for checking us out. And hopefully you like it.
Absolutely. And if you haven't checked out Killer Queens, go check them out as well.
Oh, 100%. All right.
All right.
Does that do it?
I think that's it.
Is it Patreon next week? I feel like it's already here.
Gosh, probably.
It might be.
I don't know. You know, you always ask me, and I don't know right at the end of the show.
If it is, it is. We'll see you on Patreon next week. If it's not, we'll see you on the free feed, but I think
that's
it
right.
Probably is. It sneaks up so fast.
I know. It really does. It does.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right, everybody. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. We'll see you next week, whether it's on Patreon or right here. But keep creeping. Have a great week.
Keep creeping, guys.
In the desert, we like a mirage. It's okay if you clicked on us, cause you thought we was True Crime Garage. Now we ain't mad at you. Sit down, let us talk at you. I'm talking to the Creeper Army. We out here making murder,
get murder, get murder.
True Crime Guys. In the desert, we like a mirage. It's okay if you clicked on us, cause you thought we was True Crime Garage. Now we ain't mad at you. Sit down, let us talk at you. I'm talking to the Creeper Army. We out here making murder charming.
You hush your mouth, boy.